You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hi there, I'm Sue Nelson and I'm pleased to be back again with lots of nice freebie stuff in front of me because I do like it when there's a little bit of things to taste. And I'm joined by my gorgeous co-presenter, Guy Routledge from The Food Rush. That's you, Guy.
Oh, hi, Sue. Yeah. I thought you were talking about somebody else for a change.
No, no, I was talking
about you were talking about Ollie, but he's not here, unfortunately, this
Ollie's
week.
Ollie's not here this week, but we're just soldiering without him. It means we don't have any facts and figures, but hey, you know, never mind. We're joined by Duncan O'Brien from Dalston's Cola. So I'm going to chat with Duncan first. Sarah Ward is here, who is, you know, quite a bit of a little regular on the programme, sort of, aren't you, Sarah?
I have graced these portals before, yes.
And we're very pleased to welcome Sarah because she won one of the food awards that we did for the Food Talk Show.
Absolutely, with her delicious, delicious ice cream.
Delicious ice cream. And not only that, though, but it was the one voted for by everybody else that attended the food awards. And they're all foodies and they're all food producers. Well, a lot of them
most of them are, yeah. So definitely like the People's Choice Award.
The People's Choice Award on the night, which was a little bit of a surprise to you, I think, wasn't it, Sarah? You weren't expecting it, were you? Because you're so modest.
Genuinely, I was absolutely flabbergasted because the standard of food, the things that I tasted,
fabulous,
was stunning.
Really
stunning.
Interesting stuff, yeah.
Well, we're going to see if Duncan can meet our expectations with stunning food stuff. He's frowning a huge amount there. So, Duncan, we're going to start with you. Now, can I just go back to sort of some of your history first before we talk about what you're doing now? So my lovely little researchers who love delving into people's past of all our sort of food manufacturers and people who are doing amazing stuff in food. You've got a degree in anthropology from the London School of Economics and political science.
Yep, that's right.
We have all people do all sorts
from
of stuff.
All
before,
sorts of backgrounds, isn't it?
Yes.
It's an interesting pedigree for what is now a food
it
producer.
It is. But then you left university with all that and you became a chef on the Orient Express for 2 years from 2007. I love the Orient Express. Tell me what that was like.
There really is nothing like it in food and drink, I think. I was on a train called the Royal Scotsman, which was actually bought by the Orient Express in sort of 2006, just after I joined. It's 30 passengers max. It's serving the best of Scottish food. So the train would go around a lot of private rail track and up the sort of very, very beautiful West Highland line. It would stop at certain stations and literally the mushroom man would walk out of the woods with his sack of mushrooms and the chef would poke through, select the ones that he wanted for the next day's dish. We'd meet the fisherman at Kyle of Loch Alsh. He'd get the langoustines still living and we, the chefs, would scuttle out. And it was timed so that when the passengers were sort of finishing their main course and getting ready for dessert, they'd look outside, they'd see the chefs preparing the next day's langoustines that they'd be served. It was a kind of baptism fire in food and drink, as it's quite intense. It's quite an intense kitchen. You're serving breakfast, lunch and dinner. There's two or three chefs on a moving kitchen at any one time, and you are expected to be serving the best of Scottish food.
Well, the ingredients sound incredible. Tell us about the space that you have to work in, because I'm presuming it would be tiny.
It is certainly smaller than this quite small studio that we're in now. And the main problem is it's quite thin. So to get past somebody, you have
so you
to
can't
do the
be
kind of,
fat and you, work on the... No, because nobody will be able to get round you.
You can't trust a thin chef.
I know, but you can't. There's no space. You couldn't have two people getting past each other, could you?
The problematic thing was the oven, because the oven door would swing open and you'd have to kind of duck under it to get into it, and you're having to move quite fast. So there was a lot of burning and scalding, and it was
cursing, I would imagine.
I think it was a sort of kitchen that everybody imagines how old school fine dining kitchens are, in that sort of Kitchen Confidential way. But the head chef when I was there was a guy called Ian Murray, and he trained under Andrew Fairley, the former Gleneagles chef, who has this kind of genesis of amazing Scottish chefs that have worked under him, including Tom Kitchen, the Michelin star chef in Edinburgh now. So he was the first really inspiring person that I worked for. And the first person I sort of really respected in the kitchen. Yeah.
So I've just had a little detour here. Tom Kitchen. So he's got his Edinburgh, I've forgotten what the name of the restaurant now.
I think it's Kitchen.
Is it? Oh, well, there you go.
Or the Kitchen.
Yeah. The Kitchen.
Inspired name.
So you're in this kitchen, and presumably you get to know your fellow chefs pretty well, really, because physically you're incredibly close. And you can't get the ump with somebody if you're going to work with them all the time, even though you're pushing and shoving and you know, pushing past people all the time.
Well, that's how I got the job in the first place, actually, was the chef did get the hump with one of the other chefs. Oh, and yeah. It was kind of, it wasn't very,
You've got to get on well.
He left, and then we'd get another chef in to fill the position. And because it was quite a hard job, they'd stick at it for 2 or 3 days, and then they'd literally run away in the middle of nowhere. So the cry would go up amongst the stewards, and you'd pop your head out the train window and you'd see a chef running down a platform in the middle of nowhere. He's got nowhere to go. There's nothing around.
Unbelievable.
And that's how I got in, actually, was when one of the other chefs left. So, you do get to know each other quite well, because you work quite long hours and quite long shift. So the longest shift, I think, was 22 days in a row at one point. But I'm sure it's changed now.
It is incredible. I mean, I've heard all sorts of stories and even worked in some kitchens. And it is, you know, it's literally a very warm environment because all the ovens and stuff like that. And it's very close quarters. And it's absolutely staggering, the kind of the level and quality of food that comes out of such a small room.
Yeah.
I used to work in a kitchen in Edinburgh, actually. And there was only three of us in the kitchen. But it was, you know, probably half the size of the studio we're in now, which is, 12 foot square or something. The food was impeccable, but it was, you know, just such a claustrophobic environment. I do wonder how much of it is about branding, though, and the perception and what the expectations of the customers are, because there's certain, you know, very high end Michelin star restaurants which have that kind of air of, you know, slightly more old school and almost stuffiness is what I would call it, but that's probably not what they would call it. And so maybe the types of customers who go there are expecting that kind of, you know, either standoffish or, you know, just that very almost like an androgynous type of approach to service, where it's just like they keep out of the way. Whereas in some places, some people want that really friendly, chit-chatty kind of.
I thought they got it about right, though, because they were a little bit friendly, but not too much. I must say, most people were fairly elderly on it.
On the Orient Express.
Including me, obviously.
It's something people sort of save for their whole lives, something people want to do in their later years.
Interesting.
I've never done a long trip. Have you been on it, Sarah?
No, I haven't. No, and I would love to. Mm. Absolutely. And that magical trip going from, you know, from Venice to, what a dream that would be. Can I just ask you a question, though? It's just going through my mind as you were talking. Did it take you long to adjust to the movement of the train in a tiny kitchen? Because I know if I try and lurch up and down the carriage just to the loo, I'm falling on top of people. So how do you manage not slopping hot dishes? And
I try and do that on purpose, just to meet new men. That's how I do that.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry. Hi, my name's Sue.
Back to the podcast then.
I actually started as the bartender on the train for the first 3 months of my employment, and then I got pulled into the kitchen when that chef left, and they needed somebody to literally come in and do the kind of donkey work, peeling potatoes and whatnot. So in the bar, you kind of learn quite quickly just to hold the glass in your hand, not on the bar while you're pouring it, so that your body kind of counteracts the movement of the train. But you do get used to it. Serving is much harder than actually cooking, although you I think I caught a finger a couple of times with a knife. But one thing I did remember is you sleep very well when the train is moving. You get rocked to sleep by the movement of the train. And waking up in the morning when the train is moving is a fantastic feeling. It just feels very kind of cozy. And,
that's interesting.
Really interesting.
So where do they put you then? Do they put you in some... You know, you watch those James Bond films and they always murder somebody, don't they? Or is it, or is that another film on the Murder on the Orient Express? And you see these like cabins and like that big Jaws man comes in and they're all sleeping in a little bunky bed. Do you have a little bunk bed? Do you have your own cabin?
You do. You've got bunk beds. One of the privileges of being a chef is that you get your own room generally, whereas the stewards share a bunk cabin.
So it's worth being a cook.
Share a bed.
But they're tiny little cabins right at the back with a microwave, and that's about it.
And the shower arrangements, you obviously not en suite, obviously.
No, one or two showers for the for the cabin.
You really do get to know your co-workers, don't you?
Yeah. Well, when you're going through Scotland, you can just open the window, stick your head out, and you'll be fine.
So that's your little foray into the Orient Express. After that, tell us what you did.
So that was my kind of
introduction.
And you
did that for 2 years. I mean, that's pretty good going.
I did it for 2 years and then decided to leave the UK and go off to the Caribbean as I wanted to learn to sail and just kind of fancy the idea of getting away from the UK for a bit.
You're a little bit of a hippie, aren't you?
A little bit. My mother was. My father was an accountant and actually an entrepreneur himself.
Your father was an accountant?
And my mother was a bit of a hippie, and she is a gardener and a botanist amongst all sorts of things. She used to actually work for a couple of designers in London called Robin and Lucy and Day. She was their sort of only apprentice. But I went over to the Caribbean. I got kind of lucky, actually. I was working back on the train, and I was actually I saw one of the guests was one of the directors. I think it's the director of PR for the organization, for the whole Orient Express kind of estate. And Orient Express has luxury boutique hotels all around the world. They've got a riverboat in Southeast Asia, all sorts of things. And I just got chatting and said, "Oh, I'm off to the Caribbean." And she said, "Oh, we've got a new operation out there. What, do you want to go and work there?" And I was like, "Sure."
I can't believe your luck on that one.
So I had two offers come through. One was to be a butler, and one was to be a night auditor, is what they needed. So
butler.
Being a butler is very hard.
Very, very hard.
Being a night auditor, which is essentially like the role of the night manager, is quite easy. So right. I had about 5 minutes work to do each night from midnight till 7 a.m. And then I would just talk to the security guards, read, watch films.
Very nice.
All in the Caribbean?
In St. Martin.
So if you had loads of time to yourself, you should be an amazing sailor by now.
I did actually sail back from the Caribbean after about a year. A year on St. Martin was about enough for me. So then I got a job on a boat and sailed around a few charters.
So I'm noticing now that all your jobs are like these off-kilter, non-terra firma jobs.
You can only work if he's shifting from side to side. You can't actually work.
Exactly.
It's stable.
If I stay in one place, I
working
get
in the food industry.
Yeah.
Exactly the same thing.
Well, we'll skip over all your lovely jollies, which are making me very, very, very jealous. And we're now landing into, Dorston.
Yep.
Now, Dorston is a quite famous place in London, I would say. And you decided to make cola.
Soda. When I got back from the Caribbean, I started working again, and it was straight back into the kitchen. And I was just getting a bit sick of fairly low-down kitchen jobs at that point and realised I didn't want to be a chef long-term. I managed to end up getting a job for a brilliant food sustainability organisation called Sustain, the Alliance for Better Food and Farming. And I was still doing bits and bobs of chefing, particularly with like a group of friends and a few experimental chefs I knew. One of these guys was called Steve Wilson, and his cousin had started a brilliant nightclub. A very hippie nightclub, you might say.
Why are you looking at Sarah when
you
say that?
I think he thinks you're a hippie at heart.
Yeah,
actually,
Sarah.
I did live in Dalston for a while, so I know what you're talking about. I'm down with the cool kids, let me tell you.
Whenabouts were you there?
I moved down to Kent 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago.
Right.
So prior to that.
So just about that time, Passing Clouds was established, and it's sort of a community centre and nightclub. And they wanted to have a cola as a mixer with rum for the club nights that that was more sort of ethically sound than some of the other mainstream
like Coca-Cola and Pepsi.
So what they couldn't name any of them.
We can say what we like on this show.
So what they're saying is we don't like Coca-Cola and Pepsi, but there's no alternative.
Yeah, and
there's no cola alternative.
Exactly, and we found Cola Nuts on Ridley Road Market, which is the main street food street market in Dalston. And there's a shop called Unity Stores or Unity Foods, and a lady in there from Nigeria that has Cola Nuts. And we didn't really know what Cola Nuts are.
I thought you said coconuts, but no, you said cola nuts.
Yeah, I've never heard of these.
So it's not actually a nut; it's a seed pod, and they are they come in like cocoa. You have that kind of pod. And that is full of about 17 to 23 red conker-sized seeds that you can split into. And they're a bright red on the outside, and inside they're a deep purple colour. And they contain a lot of caffeine.
Naturally contain a lot of caffeine.
Naturally occurring caffeine, and in West Africa in particular, they are broken into pieces and then chewed like you chew old chewing tobacco or snus or something like that for the kind of stimulant effect. And they're passed around at weddings and ceremonies and funerals. If you go and visit someone's house, you'll be given some kernel nut. So we started making an infusion of that with spices and some citrus. And yeah, that's how we started making kernel.
And that's the basis, or the origins, probably, of Coca-Cola and Pepsi. That's their... And that's why it's called cola.
Is why it's called cola. That's the cola part. And the coca comes from the coca plant, which cocaine is made from. But I don't think...
I think it used to have some in there, but I think it had to change over time because people got wise to it.
Surely not.
I think they took the opium out as well.
Yeah, they spoil it for everyone.
So did they just approach you and ask you to make this cola, or is it something that you had in your head? Or I just want to be in the food business, but I'm not quite sure what. And then this opportunity jumped on you.
Steve approached me about turning it into a business, as people kept saying, "Oh, you should turn this into a business. This is, you know, this might have legs." And he didn't really know what they meant. I sort of did. Being quite business minded, and I went and spoke to a brewer. One of, I think, probably one of London's best brewers, you might say, called Evan, who runs the Kernel Brewery. At that point, my former employer had, after a lunch service, she'd said, "Come on, Duncan, get on your bike." And we'd cycled over to this tiny brewery in Bermondsey, and it was Evan's first brewery, the Kernel Brewery. And I'd never seen anything like it. I thought, what? This is London. You've just got office jobs here. There's no, you know, there's no manufacturing, but this guy was making something. And that's what had appealed to me initially about chefing, was the actual making.
Creating something,
seeing the product of your sort of your labor, the product of your work in front of you, and knowing when you've done a good job or not. So I went down to see Evan and said, "Hey, I've got this liquid. How would I carbonate it and bottle it?" And he said, "Okay, you know, go on the internet and look at homebrewing forums and teach yourself. And here's my bottle supplier. And here's a couple of tricks, like use what are called Cornelius kegs. They're small pressurized kegs that actually used to be used to dispense the syrup for Pepsi and cola." I just wrote those three things down on a piece of paper, sort of scuffled off home,
shoved it in your back pocket, got on Google.
Got on the internet, started researching. Took out a payday loan to buy my first pallet of bottles and my first bits of equipment, and just started making it in my kitchen.
Amazing.
At home.
So it's not like, this isn't like the kind of classic 70s soda stream kind of thing where you're just kind of forcing carbon dioxide into something that is still. This is like almost like a brewing process.
The drinks are infusion based, so they are brewed but not fermented. But to make them fizzy, it's forced carbonation. So what I used to do is take two of these 20 liter Cornelius kegs, fill them with our liquid, our cola or our ginger beer, then you connect a regulator with a CO2 canister to them. So you're pressurizing them. So you've got your liquid and then a load of high pressure CO2. And you put an episode of The Simpsons on, and you just shake the kegs for about 15, because you've got to do it for about 15, 20 minutes. So shake the kegs, and that forces the carbon dioxide into them, makes it fizzy, and then you stick it in the fridge and you bottle it a few hours later. So.
Amazing.
Well, that easy. Now, in front of us, we have some. Can I taste some now? Because I've been looking at them for ages.
We talk a lot about branding and packaging and design and stuff on the show as well. And the design of the bottles is fantastic. But also, I was on your website earlier, and it is
the website's
top-notch.
Good, isn't it?
Really, really lovely.
Thank you very much.
You should go and check it out.
I've got here strawberry aged ginger beer, cream soda, fizzy apple. Now they're all in bottles. Excuse me. And then we've got some cans of lemonade.
Orangeade and cola. So these are just released cola. about three months ago.
I think I'm going to have to taste the cola because that's what we've been talking about.
I'm not a great fan
of cola at all. I don't drink Coke or Pepsi because I thought that was the only option. Didn't you? I mean, I thought you could, but this is interesting because
if you're talking about widely available options, there just aren't really that many. You go into all the classic, even corner shops, pubs, restaurants, everything has got those two major brands. But
they've really taken the market, haven't they?
But no, there are a few that you see here and there.
Am I expecting this to taste
different.
What I would think of?
It'll be quite different.
It has the same type of ingredients as the two rivals that we hate mentioning.
It has a lot of the same ingredients that the classic cola, the 7X ingredients.
Is it a different colour?
We've changed the recipe, I think, more times than I really care to remember over the years.
Yeah.
The most recent changes, we've taken out the kind of heavy spices and we've replaced them with like honey and vanilla flavours.
Wow. So it's a different colour.
Slightly lighter, I'd say.
It's redder.
Yeah, redder.
It? Definitely much redder.
Maybe it's just the light in here. But.
So we like to sort of explore different ingredients. And we previously used a colour called caramel colour, which is widely used in the drinks industry. And we decided we wanted to move away from that. So we started employing something called caramel. It's a dye made with carrot, hibiscus and apple, which is a kind of fits more in keeping with like how we like to make drinks.
Mm. It's really clean. You know, I don't
it's
drink a huge amount.
It's very soda-based, in it's much more soda-ish.
It's very light. It doesn't feel overly sweet.
Sarah, have you got any thoughts on
that? Well, I was just thinking how much more sophisticated. So I really can detect...
It's complicated.
Yes, complex, isn't it? Because I do recognise immediately the cola taste that we all know from so many years of, you know, mixing with rum or whatever we've done with it in the past. But...
I think that's all I've ever done.
But this is really grown up and complex and interesting, and I like it very much.
Thank you very much.
Fruity as well.
It's
like a fruity sweetness rather than a sugary sweetness.
We were at the Imbibe trade show recently, and we started. A guy I met makes craft vodka. He makes vodka in Poland, and you can really sort of. It's got a real lovely taste to it, and it goes quite well with this. It gives a kind of earthy taste. So we're trying to see if we can kind of upgrade that old like vodka coke drink to something
vodka
to something
and
a bit
coke
better.
Can't remember the last time I heard that. Yeah. So it says here hand
really
mashed. What does that mean?
It means you could double the price, I think.
You're
so such a cynic.
We make our drinks in our brew yard over in Mile End. We got actually priced out of Dalston, but we managed to. We set our first factory up at the beginning of 2013 in Hackney Wick, where we found a really nice cheap space. And then we were sort of moved out of there as they're demolishing the building about a year and a half ago. So we set up a site in Mile End, and you're welcome to visit. It operates pretty much like a brewery, and a lot of the processes are still involve my long-suffering colleague Graham making the drinks by hand. So
oh, really, wow.
Yeah, they are mainly infusion processes, and
I like that a lot.
We're moving from hand mashed as a moniker to honestly made, as it sort of more encompasses our general feelings. As I used to go to New Spitalfields Market and buy sort of a ton of lemons at a time, then drive them back to our factory, juice them on two Zoomixes. Now that's not very efficient.
It doesn't sound
definitely isn't.
And you're in trouble if the price of lemons, like the harvest failed in Argentina one year, and the price was sort of shot up by five times.
Oh wow!
So you can, if you buy in different ways, you can kind of de-risk that side of things.
Very interesting.
Can I taste the ginger beer? Because that's the other thing is when I sort of grew out a cream soda. And then I sort of thought I was sophisticated. I was about 12 or something. I started drinking ginger beer. I've always loved ginger. I absolutely adore ginger. I still do. So can I taste your ginger beer, please?
Which
you've just opened it and it's just gone all over your trousers. Yeah, yeah. But don't worry about that. Pass it over. We'll find something to mop you up with.
It's warm enough in here. It'll dry in a second.
It's a bit fizzy, isn't it?
For a couple of years, we used the ginger beer plant, which is a SCOBY. So it's a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. To partially ferment it, we'd take a tenth of each batch and we'd ferment it, and then we'd blend it back through the drink. But as we scaled up the process, as we got bigger, it got harder and harder to do. We'd occasionally lose a batch, and when you lose 1,000 liters of ginger beer, it's pretty
it can make you cry.
It's depressing. Yeah.
Well, I can taste seeing your ingredients. There, you've got a little bit of chicory root.
Yes.
Again, that makes it another nice, grown-up, sophisticated,
complicated drink.
The chicory, we like to use less sugar in our drinks. So this ginger beer here would be below the lowest sugar tax threshold. So it's 4.9 grams
per
100 ml.
Exactly the next thing I wanted to talk about.
And what happens when you take sugar out? Sugar doesn't just add sweetness, it also adds body and mouthfeel. So when you take sugar down to a certain point, you just get quite watery drinks. So chicory root fiber is, is a brilliant way of like keeping that nice thick mouthfeel. It's just a nice texture.
It's got a nice bit of feariness to it, hasn't it?
It has, and I almost feel like it might be medicinal and actually good for you.
Medicinal.
Yeah.
Well, it's real ginger. So we take a ton of ginger, we wash it, we pass it through what's called a hammer mill, we put it into muslin bags, we put that into a big kettle, 1,500 litre brewing kettle, and we boil it up, and then we filter it off.
Mm.
So it's a
proper stuff.
We're all about taste. We try to make drinks that taste.
Made me shiver, taste good, actually, but, in a way.
But yeah, it probably does have medicinal qualities. I don't know if I can say that without being sued. But, yeah. But I'm a big fan of ginger. I've always been a big fan of ginger beer.
It's good for the old circulation, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel as if this might be circulating through me.
Yes, yep. I'm liking it. Right, final one before we have a little break. I hate Cherryade. Hate it. Yeah. But you've got some. And bearing in mind all the rest of this stuff was really nice, I'm going to try yours.
Well, it's strawberry aid.
Okay, I'll try that then.
We were thinking of doing a cherry aid, and when we were looking for cherries, we did a little experimental cherry aid run about 6 months ago, and we found a beautiful farm in Essex, which had brilliant, brilliant cherry material there. And we were so impressed that we paid a visit to them about 2 months ago and said, what else have you got? Strawberries, great, fantastic.
You see, Sarah and I will disagree with you because we're from Kent, or we live in Kent, I'm not from Kent. And of course, the cherries in Kent are just incredible. So I am biased.
Well, yeah. our apple supplier, the brilliant Sam Nightingale down at Gibbet Oak Farm in Kent near Tenterden, who we work quite closely with. He does grow strawberries, he does grow cherries, but not in great enough quantities.
Wow, you need the quantity, don't you?
It's got to be volume. So we developed this strawberry head for a certain very well-known tennis competition that I don't think we're allowed to talk about.
Are Wombles from there as well?
Possibly, yeah.
So you've developed that for that place where the Wombles live.
So it's being sold there now. So just a kind of a limited edition run. And if people like it, then we will probably end up canning it.
Well, bearing in mind how much you have to pay for a little bowl of strawberries when you go to that place that we're not allowed to talk about, then probably having them bottled a better idea. Can we have a little taste of that? I've still got that ginger running through
really
me.
Nice.
I mean, in a really big way.
That might have obliterated your palate, actually. But
probably.
You can probably definitely get the smell of the strawberries, but so it's the same kind of profile.
We've got a beautiful colour, obviously. Here we go. Wow.
So it's the same kind of lower sugar profile, or less sugar profile.
Actually, I really like. Oh God, I really like that.
Super simple, isn't it?
I'd so like that.
Oh, it smells like a bowl of strawberries, doesn't it?
Goodness,
it's just fantastic. I wish I hadn't tasted the rest now. I'll just have that. Can you not drink too much of that? Because I'd like some more.
So nice.
I'm sure you can.
Isn't that fantastic?
That is absolutely gorgeous.
Strawberries. The essence of strawberries. Mm.
Thanks very much.
Oh. You should be proud of that one.
It sounds like we probably should can it then.
I think you should.
I think you should, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. So where can I get that? I can't at the moment. This is just your...
That is not available at the moment.
Snaffle that one then.
We can probably send some into you, but we've got I think we've got 10 or so cases left, and we might if we keep getting this kind of feedback, we'll stick it into production.
That is fabulous, and it's not sugary sweet. It just tastes of strawberries.
Mm. Yep.
Nothing else really.
It's fantastic.
It is amazing. Yeah.
Refreshing. Fantastic. Beautiful.
We've talked a little bit, or mentioned a couple of times, this idea of the low sugar, and so. There is this thing called the sugar tax. I can't remember if it's come in yet or if it's just on the horizon.
It's not come in yet.
April 2018.
Yeah, next year. And this is something that we've mentioned on the show before, because I think I remember talking about it previously. But it's this kind of levy that has come in for the producers who make a drink which is high in sugar. I think over 5% of the kind of liquid by volume or whatever has to be less. To come under the threshold. So is this something that you've intentionally done to try and keep the sugar low, or is this because you think it actually improves the flavour?
So, again, we're just all about taste. So this sugar debate has really come to the fore in the last, I'd say, 2 years. Mm. And we've been going about sort of four and a half years. Our drinks were always about half to two-thirds of the sugar of, standard mainstream drinks. I mean, you probably know in the food industry, there's a general practice, if you want to make something cheap, taste good, you add fat, sugar, or salt to it.
Yep.
So we've got a very kind of overloaded, fatty, sugary, salty food industry. If you use better quality ingredients, if you use really nice ingredients, you don't need to use so much sugar. That's what we found kind of naturally. But when the sugar debate really did start sort of bubbling up, we applied for and got a small £5,000 something called an innovation voucher, which from the government, from the Technology and Skills Council, and that allowed us to conduct a bit of research into how we would further reduce sugar. And actually, we identified a variety of maybe three or four main routes, some of which we're still working on and probably going to put into practice. But one of the best things to come out of that research was the chicory root fibre. So we didn't know about that as an ingredient beforehand.
That's brilliant.
We went and spoke to a bunch of experts and brilliant food scientists. And
I mean, my worry is that they're just going to shove it full of artificial sweeteners, which I'm not convinced is very good for you either.
Yeah, there are a lot of kind of chemically ones, and there are some kind of more natural ones as well.
They taste horrible, though, don't they? You must, let's face it.
Yeah, we will never use...
Stevia's just...
Stevia is natural.
It's got that aftertaste, isn't it?
It's horrible. You can't get rid of it. I mean, we know loads of people have tried to use it and really struggled with it.
Yep.
Yes, that's a good way of getting around it, I suppose, is just be natural, please.
Yeah, I mean,
as much as you can.
That idea of, you know, good, honest food, you know, well made by, you know, with local ingredients is, you know, is such a hot topic at the moment. So this seems to be embracing it wholeheartedly.
So we're gonna come back in a few minutes and have a really good old chat with Sarah. While we're listening to something else in a minute, I'm gonna drink some more of that strawberry stuff. So get your hands off, Guy. Yeah, and actually I might have a bit of more of the ginger afterwards because that's pretty fiery. Mm. Quite like that. So we're just gonna have a little break and we'll see you when we come back. And in that time, we are going to listen to Jamie Hughes of Nova UK, who's come up with the most amazing nonstick saucepan. Here's Jamie.
Hello, it's Harry from the Food Talk Show. I'm at the last day of the Allergy and Free From Show, and I'm with Jamie from Nova UK. Now, he's not doing food like a lot of the people are. He's got a big stall with some granite saucepans and frying pans, and he's going to give me a little bit of a demonstration while I watch. So, Jamie, thanks for coming on to the Food Talk Show. Can you explain a little bit about what you're doing here?
Yep, so what they are is a non-stick, non-scratch cooking, so you don't need any grease, fat or oil. So literally you can burn cheese into the base of a pan and it will literally not stick. So, I'm going to burn it into the base of the pan. The great thing is about these pans, they have a great back. So what it does is it evenly distributes the heat with 100% accuracy across the whole pan. If anyone's ever bought like a Teflon pan with a little red dot in the middle, it's actually got a chemical inside called Teflon. So at 165 degrees, it actually releases a chemical into your food. They've actually banned it in Australia. They're about to ban it in Europe. As these ones here are PFOA-free and PTFE-free. So Teflon's also chemical-free. Now, if you was to burn cheese into the base of your pan at home, the first thing you'd have to do is scrape it, soak it. Worst case scenario, you'd have to chuck the whole pan in the bin. Now watch this, non-stick, non-scratch. Now if there's anything left over as well, don't worry, just grab yourself a bit of paper towel or a cloth, and this is how easy we are to clean. You just wipe out like so, and have a clean pan ready to be used all over again. But by the way, they're 100% dishwasher safe. Let me show you one last quick job, my favourite, a very quick one egg omelette. Now it's very important to remember, folks, everything we sell is German made and manufactured, very high in quality. Now that is a completely dry pan, now watch this. Now these are perfect for pancake batters, stir fries, chicken, fish or steak. The great thing about these pans is they will go on any hob. It will go on gas, electric, agar, barbecue or even induction. The reason why we sell so many is the whole pan and the handle will go in the oven. So you can bake your cakes, do your frittatas, grill chicken, fish or steak. But just imagine never cooking with grease, fat or oil for the rest of your life. It's the most healthiest way of cooking. Now, did I use any grease? Any fats? Any oil? Are we all excited? Watch this. No grease, no fats, no oil. It's the UK's best-selling non-stick pan you can buy. Now, what is the next most important question? How much are they? Where can I get for what do I get for my money? Now, you can buy them at live shows like this all over the world. You might have even seen us on the TV shopping channel. Our large 28-centimetre frying pan normally retails at £59.99. They're not cheap. They're made and manufactured in Germany. They're built to last. They're not built to break.
So that's a great demonstration. Thanks. I mean, for someone that cooks quite a lot, watching you put cheese into a pan without any oil gave me a little bit of a heart attack. So obviously, that's great to see. How has the show been going for you? Obviously, you've been doing demonstrations for the last 3 days. I imagine you're pretty tired.
Yeah, it's gone well. It's ticking along. It's a good show to be at. Obviously, the allergy show, so it's quite good for the pans. Allergy, obviously, they're all free of all chemicals. Nothing leaks into your food, so it's quite popular at the show.
Okay, so whereabouts can we get our hands on one of your products?
You can buy them today at the show. Obviously, it's a show we go all the way around the country. Or you can go online at novauk.com.
And sort of 5 years down the line, do you reckon these are being sold everywhere? Everyone will be cooking with these?
Hopefully, yeah. We'll be all around demonstrating every week, so yeah.
Fantastic. Where can people find out more information? Do you have a website, social media?
You can go on to www.novauk.com.
Okay, brilliant. Thank you very much, and good luck for the rest of the show.
Thank you.
So there we go. That was Jamie Hughes of Nova UK. Must get hold of one of those saucepans. Yes, there
Sounds really interesting.
So here we are back, and we're with Duncan O'Brien of Dalston's Cola. We've now finished off all his strawberry, more or less. We're fighting over that one. And I'm just about to have some more ginger. It's hot as usual in the studio, so we need that, don't we?
It's very refreshing, I have to say, have all these things in.
And it's lovely to see you again, Sarah. Hello. You've been on the show before. We had a great time at the Food Awards.
We did,
and
yes.
Everybody just loved your stuff.
It's so exciting.
Which one did you bring there? Because I know you've got lots of lovely favourites.
It was the passion fruit martini.
Passion fruit martini.
It seemed to win people over, which was just wonderful, actually.
It certainly did. And we had some very, very knowledgeable food people there, and people who've you know, been in the food business a long time. And that was the one they voted for the best food product they had all that night.
Yeah.
So pretty proud of that.
And so just to kind of set the scene, I guess it's worth mentioning that this is an alcoholic ice cream that you make.
Whole brand is based on famous classic cocktails that, you know, well known, many of which go back for many years, you know, probably created back in the 1930s. And they all have a wonderful history behind them. And they're certainly my favourite cocktails, things like pina colada, you know, the martini, the brandy Alexander, margarita.
Your margarita's nice. I've had that.
Thank you.
We've got a little stack in our office because last time you came to see us, you left us loads.
They've
been in the freezer and people keep dipping
in.
Yeah. Every office needs a stack.
Yeah, I was going to say, exactly. Can you concentrate, please, guys? Because we're doing tax returns here and you're eating all Sarah's boozy added ice cream. You also did these limited edition flavours, which were great as well, because I remember tasting the strawberry daiquiri.
Yes, and that's the one that's out obviously right now. It's the sort of June to the end of August one. What I tried to do was have a set of flagship flavours that everybody, it sort of becomes synonymous with boozy udders, but then also to bring in seasonal flavours. And it's that thing of going back to keeping your product as natural as you can, and obviously seasonal too, so using seasonal local fruits. And again, as C mentioned earlier, living in Kent, we're just so lucky there. Just the amount of wonderful fruit farms that, you know, you can get your produce fresh.
And so everything comes from the local area, does it?
When it can. You don't get many passion fruit farmers, groves in Kent.
It's a shame. There should be more, I think.
You don't know anything about this, do you?
About growing passion
fruit. Fruit farmer, no. No, it's not going to work.
I have this brilliant veg delivery box that comes every week, and there were some passion fruits in it, and there were surplus passion fruits from, you know, some pack house locally or something like that. So I don't know where they came from originally, but, you know, obviously stuff does come around from time to time.
Well, we love that product, and obviously with the packaging we've talked about before, it's good
fun. Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that I'd probably like to take and have a dinner party, pretend I made it myself, because it's just got that lovely homemade.
It's a great gift to take as well, because everyone brings a bottle of wine and it's like, oh, brilliant, I'll put that at the bottom of the rack and we'll take it to yours next time.
Actually, I had so many people over the last couple of years buying four or six of either the small or the larger 500ml pots and giving them as Christmas presents to close friends, because it's unexpected and it's the sort of gift that you know, it's quite a delight to receive something like that.
Absolutely. Or indeed strawberry cola, whatever it is.
Well,
I'd quite like to receive a case of that. So Sarah, I know that your background, you were an actress and a jazz singer by trade, and you studied theatre and dramatic art, and then you've got a family and you're juggling a very busy family life.
Yeah.
You started off boozy udders.
Yes.
You didn't particularly have much experience in the food sector.
No.
I'd be very interested now, you know, especially with Duncan here, your sort of story of how do you go from making stuff at home to now it's becoming very successful. You know, how do we move on from there? And Duncan was saying he took a payday loan. Not sure that's a good idea, but anyway, you know, and all that sort of stuff. How have you managed to get to where you are so far?
Well, when I first started, I talked to my husband about my ideas, and he said, look, you're never going to make that work. Please don't go down that avenue. So I felt I had
very
to do it well.
No,
sensible.
What a good man.
He's also a really keen business brain, you know. So he was looking at it from, you know, a financial business head point of view. And actually, if you look at it from that point of view, he's probably quite right. But I'm mildly stubborn. So I just thought I'd do
it. Or in my case, if my husband says not to do something, I'll just do it anyway, just to annoy him.
That's kind of what I meant, really. Yeah. Russ knows that about me. So I just started doing it a little bit secretly in the kitchen at home. And I got the local council man to come round without telling my husband and to check out the kitchen. And he gave me the okay. He basically
said... So some people will have like a secret affair, but not you. No, I'm going to have a secret ice cream making, you know, sort of thing going on.
Certainly wasn't going to have an affair with my council man.
No, so he sort of said, well, look, your kitchen's fine as long as you're producing less than 20 litres a week, which I thought was slightly amusing because I thought, well, OK, so it's OK to kill a small amount of people as long as if you get over 20 litres, you're not insured.
It's madness, isn't it?
So, but it went from there. And one Saturday I'd been sourcing packaging and things, and when all these boxes of packaging arrived and pots and things, and my husband went, what on earth is going on? And that's when he came in with me. Then he decided that actually this was exciting and he liked what I was doing, and I'd been eking the financial side of it out of the housekeeping and stuff like that.
So he didn't even know that you were like, oh my goodness. So you're pilfering all this money out of the household account. What are you saying? Oh yeah, I've got a new dress, love. No, she's spending it on,
instead of hiding my shoes in the closets, there were boxes of tubs in the closet.
Oh, dear me.
And really, he got excited about it then. So that was just over a year ago. So I'd already built up, probably a bit longer actually, more like 18 months. And I'd already built up some local interested customer base from farm shops and delis and people like that. And he started really encouraging me. And we realised that the only way we could work out if it was going to go to the next level and be worth doing was to sort of launch it, do a soft launch at the NEC in Birmingham, which is the Farm Shop and Deli Show.
Mm. Yeah.
So that's what we did about 15 months ago. And it went so well. And we won Best New Product Idea there.
Fantastic.
And that's when my husband went,
so did you say to him,
it.
Did you say to him, see? No, 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 see?
Told you so.
If only you knew how many times I've said that. Yeah. And he got excited. And what? And this is sort of where we're at now. It's quite an interesting place because what he said was, I'm so excited by this, but I can't, he already has his own line of business, his own company. And he said, I can't do it both. I can't help you and do this. So he agreed to put his own company on the back burner and really throw himself hook, line and sinker into this, because at that stage we couldn't afford to take people on. Mm. So
that's,
it was him and
leap.
Me.
Yeah,
it was a big leap, and so it was a hard leap.
Did he pause his business, or did he just leave somebody else in charge of it?
Yes, he sort of did, just left
right,
it ticking
so it's
over,
ticking
but
he's over.
It's still
right.
ticking. So we poured ourselves into it this last year, and we went to obviously what most food companies and drink companies have to do, which you may have done yourself, is go to the trade shows and, you know, you set up your stand and you need to get as much coverage as possible.
And people are doing that because the buyers walk around there, don't they? Mm, I mean, they're the ones who have their badges turned around the other way. Because they don't want anybody to know who they are.
Yes.
But so many buyers visit there, don't they?
They really
that's
do.
A good place to be.
They really do. And it is the important thing to do when you're just starting out, I think, in a food business, if you can, because these shows are not cheap, but you have to somehow be able to fund it into put it into the mix. And from that we gained, in very speedy time, in a very short length of time, we gained sort of up to 80 local customers and actually the length and breadth of England. And then the real hard work began. And we moved into a kitchen premises close by us near Tunbridge Wells, which was amazing. And it was me making it, and I had two people helping me, and we really built up a sort of a regular business of just volume and exciting new customers. We went to some restaurants. They started putting on their menus, and it's sort of taken us to the Food Talk Awards at the end of this year.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, that's sort of.
And so what sort of volume are you doing when you're at the stage you're at now?
Well, we have taken a little pause because we had a slight change in situation. So when we were at our peak in the summer, we were making up to 100 litres a day by hand.
Yeah.
And that's just myself and two helpers. Sometimes it was just me and one person. We have a mixer, a 20 litre mixer called Big Bertha.
But this is still very manual. And Duncan,
very manual.
You know, what you're saying is actually still very manual, isn't it? Because that's how you want the control. That's how you want the quality.
Yeah.
But that does give you problems, doesn't it?
Scaling is a real challenge, scaling up a sort of cottage industry. industry grown food or drink business, and I think the challenges are always the same. One of the biggest ones for me that I didn't realize was distribution. So I didn't have a clue going into Dawson's Cola about how important distribution is and how important drinks distribution is. We had our own van and we used to drive all of our drinks around London to our customers in London and deliver them that way.
Costs a fortune, though.
It costs a lot, and it's very hard to scale up. You've got to buy more vans, get more drivers.
Yeah.
Whereas really there are fantastic professional drinks distribution companies out there that have, you know, one company will have 50 vans, 50 lorries, and they'll have a bunch of customers. So,
and I'm sure they can introduce you into other places as well and recommend this and that. Yep.
So how are you distributing then? So,
well, that's what Duncan's just talked about is one of our biggest challenges, or has been over this last year. Excuse me. And I think also I didn't know at the time when I first started, not that it would have put me off, but it was a sort of baptism of fire that I had chosen one of the most difficult areas to get into just because of the logistics of distribution.
Well, he's very sensible here. He's got ambient.
Yeah. Yes.
Whereas you've got frozen.
Really, really difficult. And like yourself, Duncan, we were doing a lot of the deliveries ourselves when it was possible, sort of within the M25 area in the south. But then, of course, we had to use frozen food couriers. So that is something you really have to get on top of when you're embarking on a food business that involves frozen food.
There's just so many different things to think about. Not only we've also got to, you know, build a website and do the packaging and make the thing and then, you know, tell everybody about it, go onto the radio and get in the press and all this. So many things. Not to put anybody off.
What's happened with a lot of the craft breweries is they've been able to scale their packaging. So they've been able to scale in-house bottling and even in-house canning quite effectively. There's a problem with soft drinks in that we need to pasteurize our drinks. And that, if you want to go to an automated pasteurization system, you need what's called a tunnel pasteurizer. Now, you don't need that in beer. So it's a piece of equipment you just don't need. And unfortunately, the smallest tunnel pasteurizer will cost you about £150,000.
And that's the leak you've got to make.
Steam,
and it won't fit in your kitchen.
Steam generator probably won't fit in your kitchen. and so there's just this pasteurization is just a technical difference between beer and soft drinks and craft beer and craft soda. That mean that you have to find external packages. So you have to work with co-packers. So when we moved from Hackney Wick to our second factory, Hackney Wick, we did everything. We made every aspect of the drinks in-house and then delivered ourselves. Our second factory, we make the liquid, and then we work with cold storage. So we send that the liquid in cold storage to a bottler that we work very closely with.
So what you're doing, in essence, is you're chunking the process up and looking at the whole process end-to-end and then saying, we can do that in-house. We can get somebody to do that. We can do it. Yours is a little bit of a seasonal product. I mean, people are eating ice cream and stuff all the way around the year, a little bit more than they used to.
I imagine it's more in the summer though, yeah.
So are you in that process like Duncan where you're saying, all right, how can we chunk this up and give this to somebody? We'll do this, we'll do that. Is that your next leap?
It sort of is. Going back to talking about the seasonal aspect of it, I think that has been a challenge, and I think it must be for all ice cream brands out there. There is definitely a dip when it's non-seasonal, sort of September to November and, you know, January to April. There's that definite dip. Buziadas is a little bit different because it's very much a luxury pudding product. So it's the sort of thing, Sue, as you mentioned earlier, you would bring out at a dinner party or as a naughty weekend treat, you know. So I think part of the challenge and part of the interest of the job really is getting customers to understand it in a different light. It's not just an ice cream that you walk along the beach with.
So I think often we've said on the programme, there isn't this sort of like nice sort of little curve in growth often. Or there might be in growth, actually, but in terms of costs. And quite often what happens with costs is you have a step change in costs if you want to get to the next level. And there's always this gap, isn't there, where you think, I've got my sales at this level. Are they going to stay at this level? Therefore, shall I invest this money or not? And that's the massive decision to take, isn't it? You know, because it's a risk, really. And you're beginning to really sink everything into it.
Well, exactly. And this is the point that we're at right now. Mm. We have sunk everything into it in terms of energy and our focus. And I think being fair at the risk of family life, really, because last year was very hard. Russ and I were at trade shows a lot. Yeah. There was a period of about 6-7 weeks where we worked 7 days a week back to back. And the only reason for that is because it was just the two of us.
Yeah.
And so what we would have looked to do, or what we were looking to do, is to build the team. And for that, to take it to the next level, you need to build volume. And of course, we need some investment. Yep. So that's the area that we've been in the last couple of months. We have come to an interesting stage where we've had to really do a lot of soul searching and work out what's best for us. And because Boozy Adders has got to such a stage where people are in love with it, and they do love the brand, and I'm so proud of what we've created. I think it's a really strong brand. But my husband now has to step back. He always intended stepping back after a year and going back to his business, which is also doing well, and he can't turn his back on that any longer. So I've had to really think about it. And we are now in a position, we think, to sell Boozy Udders, simply because I don't feel that I can continue putting my children, who are only 7 and 9, in that little niche where I'll be home soon, darling. I've really missed them last summer, and I think they missed a lot of lot of the family stuff that we're normally a very close family, and it was been very, very trying on us as a family. So
the problem with selling, though, of course, is that you've got to prove that somebody couldn't actually start that from scratch themselves. So what in essence you're doing is you're saying, I've got an amazing brand here, because the brand is what they're buying.
And that's in many cases what most people are buying. Yeah.
But also in some of your processes, I think, are quite difficult to replicate. You've managed to get the taste profile right.
Well,
now, what
I think
can do is shortcut that for somebody where they don't have to go through that process themselves.
Yeah, exactly. You've done all the innovation and also, you know, built the brand.
Well, we've built it, and we now believe that it would be quite hard for us to take it to the next level, and that it would be much more exciting for the brand. It's one of those things where you have to think, is this an ego thing? Am I doing this for ego, to keep a hold of the brand? Or actually, do I believe in the brand so much that I'm willing to let it go for somebody else to come in who knows what they're doing? Because we have not been in the food industry before. And so with a lot of soul searching, we've agreed that it would be best if somebody else came in, and I would be so willing, if it was of interest, to stay as consultant to develop the flavours. There's lots of different ways of looking at it and options and opportunities, I think. But certainly, it needs to get to the next level if it's going to start being a serious contender. Yep. And of course, in any food product or drink product, you're going to have competitors, and people will start doing the same sort of thing. As you said, mentioned a couple of other brands out there doing it, which to me is exciting, because it shows that there really is a market for it. Yeah. People are loving it, and there's a market for it. And I would love to think that Boozy Adders might be approached by somebody who felt they could really take it to that next level. Yeah,
must have been a really hard decision.
Yeah, very hard.
It has been.
Would you ever sell, Duncan?
I think it's probably a bit too early to think about that. But I would. And the reason I went into this business was because I thought that I could grow something in the right way, do it properly, and build a valuable business. So that is my idea, and I've actually, I've got an idea for my next business, and I had that before I started Dalston, so it's part of a larger plan for me.
We had James, I can never pronounce his surname.
Oh, James Avedik.
Avedik, that's it. On the programme the other week, who created Goo Desserts, and then obviously sold that for huge amounts. And
$32.5 million, I think.
Something like that.
So I absolutely love what I'm doing, but I probably don't want to be making soft drinks for the rest of my life, just because, you can learn quite a lot about the industry in the 4 years that I've been in it, the 4 or 5 years I've been in it. And I imagine I'll want to go off and learn about a different industry in 5 years' time, something like that.
I think James said this very much on the programme when he was here, is that you learn so much. You think, right, if I'm going to do this again, and he's actually, funny enough, gone into ice cream himself.
And yogurts.
And he just absolutely knows what he will and won't do this time, because the learning curves are so great, aren't they, in the food industry. And distribution being his number one, he absolutely wants to get that sorted.
Absolutely. I think it's almost a shame if you do something once and then never again, because then you don't get to apply all of that learning and all of that experience. And all of that perspective. I mean, certainly I've tried many things in the past, and every time it's, I've gone further, I've invested more money or more time or more effort or had more people involved. And every time it's, it's a new challenge, but it's, even more exciting. And, you get even further every time.
Just keep going.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's like banging your head against the wall sometimes, yeah. But yeah. You know, that's
something that everybody says is that it takes a lot longer than you'd expect it to. Absolutely. Anything that you plan for, it's going to take double, triple the amount of time. So.
Yeah. But maybe that's good. Maybe the human spirit's good, because if you actually really, really said this is going to take 5 years, you probably wouldn't do it. Yeah, like, yeah, this will take me 2 years.
And if you realised how hard it would be on personal relationships, you probably wouldn't do it in the first place.
Mm. Yeah, it has been a massive learning curve, but it has been such a positive one as well. Mm-hmm. And something really great has come out of it in terms of the brand itself, yeah, you know. And I'm so proud of it. Yeah,
you should be.
And would you do it again?
Oh, yes, I would. But it's just we'll see where we get to over the next month or so. But yeah, I'm full of ideas. But
amazing.
Yeah, just want to see where we get to with this.
Well, as usual, Guy, we've run out of time right in the middle of
A fascinating conversation. I know. It always seems to happen.
As usual. Well, I thank you so much, Sarah, actually, for being so honest, about where you were and talking about, selling it. And it's a big dilemma for anybody, isn't it, when you hit that. And we're also finding in the food sector that everybody says it is so all-absorbing.
I hope it's been
completely absorbing.
I think every kind of business is, but the food is particularly challenging.
Mm. And thank you very much, Duncan, from Dalston's Cola. And
you're
if you haven't tried Dalston's Cola, then you really should. And I particularly advise you to try the strawberry if he manages to get it into mainstream production, as opposed to selling it to people who are where the Wombles live. and I definitely would try the ginger beer. And the cream soda.
They were all fantastic. Definitely,
all very good.
You can find them in Waitrose Nakado now, just a very recently.
Waitrose Nakado. So that's Dalston's Cola. And if you don't know how Dalston's spelt, it's Dalston. Well, you've been listening to the Food Talk Show with me, Sue Nelson, and my fellow presenter, Guy Routledge. The gorgeous guy. You can hear our show on numerous radio stations now. I mean, too many to mention, actually, from California to the Kent coast, Manchester to Michigan, and even Malta. If you want to download any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to foodtalk.co.uk. Or if you want to tell me how amazing I am, you could Twitter.
did I write that down?
No, I was just doing that for a change. Because I normally say, if you want to moan at Guy, please tweet at Food Talk Show. What we'd quite like as well is if you could suggest a guest as well. Anybody you think is doing something incredible in the food space, please give us a tweet.
Yeah, just reach out. We love chatting to people.
We love chatting to people. So thank you for listening, and we look forward to catching you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.